this is the last of the lectures, and as we indicated in those notes, the idea is to look at South Africa more specifically. And I'm really delighted that Joel Nchitenze has been able to come down. Joel is, in my view, certainly one of the most important of the ANC's intellectual thinkers, often been quite controversial. He starts life as in Radio Freedom. Many of us knew him before as Peter Mayabui. So when this Nchitenze guy pitched up back in South Africa, a lot of us less knowledgeable people saying, who the hell is this oak? You know, seems to be with all the big guys and the big delegations. I said, no, it's Peter. Oh, okay. So he's had a long involvement with the liberation struggle and on the national executive of the African National Congress at present, and played a very key role in the policy formulation of the ANC, and was the head of the Presidential Coordinating and Advisory Services, in which capacity he was dealing with both policy and the communication services. So I think, as an insight into current South Africa, I can't think of many better people. Joel.
Thanks, Professor Ewing, and I always enjoy saying this. I've known him over the years as a comrade and then an honorable minister. At least now I can call him Professor. In case you might be wondering what Mapungubwe is, the thing on your left, it's an institute that we have just set up. Mapungubwe Institute for Strategic Reflection, which seeks to do research on matters that are of strategic and long-term importance to the country. If you are interested in these issues, you can access us on www.mistra.org.za. We are interacting with the various universities, and we've got people who are participating in the research projects that we have started to undertake. I was requested to speak on South Africa's developmental capacity as a contribution to the discourse that has been happening over the week. And what I am going to cover are the five questions that are listed on the screen. Are we a developmental state? And how has policy discourse evolved in South Africa, especially post 1990, on this issue of a developmental state? What attributes should a developmental state have? And if we have to move to a new growth trajectory, what is the broad storyline that should describe that trajectory? And lastly, the capacities that such a state, and particularly ours, should have. So are we a developmental state? I don't know what transpired during the course of the week. But to give an illustration about some of the deficits that we have, in relation to what has happened in developmental states. During the global economic crisis, as you can see there, if we compare change in GDP, the contraction that was happening in the various countries, compared to change in employment, there is a story that emerges. Germany in 2009 contracts by about 5%, but employment by 4%, UK 6.2%, and South Africa contracts by about 1.8%, but employment contracts by 6%. And what this illustrates is the deficit that we have in terms of social compacting, in terms of leadership. Tendency in South Africa amongst all leaders of the social partners, when they interact to identify issues that are important for the country, it's palling, negotiation of palling. Each sector demands its pound of flesh, and the outcome is the lowest common denominator. Whereas in places like Germany, workers and employers huddled together, agreed that there was a crisis that was impacting on both the private sector and the workers, and therefore there should be shorter working hours and packages have to be reduced and so on. In South Africa, the opposite was the case. In fact, whilst employment was contracting by that magnitude, wages increased by some 20%. This is the kind of interaction that is distinct from what one would call dialogue at a strategic level, where when the social partners interact, they pose to themselves the question, where is it that we want to go? What is our vision? What are our objectives? What contribution can each sector make to the achievement of those objectives? What are the benefits that they can derive from that? But even more critically, which is quite difficult in South Africa, what are the sacrifices that each sector can make to the attainment of a common objective? It's one of the characteristics of a developmental state. So even when we had that job summit in 1998 and the growth and development summit in 2003, the leaders of the various sectors came with their own sectoral demands. And the outcome, although it was billed as a major achievement, or in both summits they were billed as major achievements, in fact, they were the lowest common denominator that could be achieved. And the recent discourse on the new growth path shows this quite clearly. Proposal is made, I'm not saying it's right or wrong, that there would have to be a cap on salary increases, on packages of managers and so on. And the business community say we're going to take the government to court. The trade union movement also resists this. We do not have that discourse that identifies the strategic interest of the country in order to move to a higher trajectory. Now, how has discourse evolved on the notion of a developmental state? You won't find references to a developmental state in many of the ANC documents pre-1990. But around 1992, when the document that preceded the RDP policy document was drafted, there was some reference, but passing reference to a developmental state. Then in 1998, a document developed jointly by the ANC and its alliance partners, COSATU, the party, and the civic organizations, also refers, but somewhat in passing, to a developmental state. And similarly, the 2000 strategy and tactics document that was adopted at the ANC's national conference in Stellenbosch, there's passing reference to this. It's only after 2004 that the concept of a developmental state started to find elaborate pride of place as an objective of policy in ANC and government documents. And there is a long treatment of this in the 2007 ANC strategy and tactics document that was adopted at the Polokwane conference. And by the way, elaboration of an intention to build a developmental state is quite unique in any country. Professor Linda Ways of Sydney University made this point at a seminar that we had at the Human Sciences Research Council last year, that South Africa has set itself the unusual and challenging goal of becoming a developmental state. This is a unique and noble enterprise, and it's unique because no state has ever self-consciously set out to become a developmental state. Talk about Japan, Malaysia, South Korea, and others. It was post facto that analysts said it's a developmental state that made this possible. So a priori, South Africa is saying we have got this objective of building a developmental state. In part is because South Africans like examining, interrogating concepts, but we have got the advantage that we achieved our democracy late in the day and are able, therefore, to learn from other countries. So why did comprehensive discourse on a developmental state start in the period, especially after 2004? In part, in my view, it arose as a consequence of the discussions that were taking place both in government and the ANC about progress that had been made since 1994. I remember, and Alec would also remember, at one of the meetings where we were presenting as the policy unit the 10-year review in 2003, the question was posed, but why do we have that average growth rate per annum of 3% between 1994 and 2004? Why are we not like the Asian tigers? So an analysis of the pedestrian nature of our growth and the unsustainability of the macro-social environment started to influence the policymakers seriously to look at this question of high growth rates and the benefits that can derive from that. Because in that review, amongst others, we noted that they were not changing the structure of the economy. Yes, increased services, but manufacturing capacity was somewhat declining, low savings, low involvement of small and micro enterprises, and so on. Also recognize that we have a very low labor participation rate. If I'm not mistaken, it's in the mid-40s, and compared to other developing countries, I think we are some 10, 15 percentage points behind, in the sense that their labor participation rate is in the 60s. And our unemployed are also, or many of our unemployed are also unemployable. Yes, we had reduced poverty, and we continue to do so, income poverty in particular. But yes, in part, it's as a result of employment that is being created, or that was being created. But in the main, social grants. There were about 2.5 million people dependent on social grants in 1993. That had increased to 12 million in 2008. But the reality is that 49% of the population, almost half, live below the poverty datum line of 524 rand per month. And inequality has not been reduced much. And there is an acknowledgement, there was an acknowledgement then to 2003 as well as in 2008 when we did the 15-year review, that this kind of macro-social dynamic is unsustainable. Especially to depend on social grants in order to deal with the challenges of of poverty is unsustainable. There were instances in that period where provinces like Gauteng and others, because the social grant is a legal right, had to reduce their expenditure in education and health and other social services in order to ensure that they are able to meet this demand. Unemployment amongst the youth is at about 49%. That's 18 to 35, almost half. And you are talking about young people who have never known what it means to work. And attached to that naturally are many social pathologies, including the nature of our violent crime and so on. That's why we're saying that macro-social dynamic is unsustainable, and therefore you need higher rates of growth and growth that can be shared amongst the population. So in the discussions that took place both in the ANC and in government, the question arose, what then would be the attributes of a South African developmental state? What capacities should it have? Firstly, it should be strategic orientation. In terms of its policy orientation, in terms of its programs, it should pursue high rates of growth, restructuring of the economy, socio-economic inclusion, and so on, what some would refer to as people-driven and people-centered policies. It should also have ideational capacity. That is the capacity, firstly, to define a vision, but to influence and mobilize society to take part in the implementation of that vision. And it should have effective systems of interaction with all social partners. Social compact that I was referring to earlier. Should also have organizational capacity. The macro organization of the state should be such that it facilitates the realization of the objectives that have been set. And it should also have technical capacity, which should include the capacity on the part, especially of the bureaucracy, to translate broad objectives into programs and projects, ensure their implementation, monitor and evaluate that implementation and so on, which would require proper training, orientation and leadership of the public service. A number of these things are elaborated in that ANC strategy and tactics document adopted in 2007. However, in that debate, we went further to say that under South African conditions, you need other attributes to this developmental state. Amongst others, because what some call developmental citizenship is not an immediate and automatic consequence of high rates of economic growth. In the interactions that we have had with the peers in South Korea, in China, Malaysia, and elsewhere, what we did notice is that many of those countries that had high rates of growth had poor social security programs. Especially the Koreans in South Korea were saying this became even more patent during the Asian economic crisis in 1998. Because I believe that implied in the approach of developmental states as we know them, it's a long-term trickle-down mechanism. Through high rates of growth, you are able to lift people out of poverty through employment, skilling, and so on. Now, in our situation, besides the constitutional imperatives that we have, about progressively providing social services, education, housing, health, and so on. Given our levels of inequality and the history of racial exclusion, a long-term trickle-down approach would not be sustainable because many people would remain excluded, especially the unemployed and unemployable that I was referring to earlier. Thus, we said a South African developmental state should also include what we termed the best attributes of social democracy. Attention to social issues such as health, education, and a social safety net. Voluntary social partnership and strong relations with the union movement. And a developmental, or rather a democratic developmental state. When many started, I think except for Japan, they had what some people would call benevolent dictatorships. Urban legend has it, for instance, that the general in South Korea, in trying to influence the private sector to behave in a particular manner, he locked them up over a weekend. And when he released them, said, "This is what we want to do, want you to do." And out of that, I suppose, has emerged Hyundai and Kia and all other big companies. But the point here is that in the South African situation, you need to combine state leadership with legitimacy that is premised on democracy, and that is not easy. There have been debates that have taken place amongst some economists and social historians as to whether you can have very high rates of growth in democracies. And fortunately, India is confirming that that is possible. Now, what gives us hope that if we are not a developmental state, we have got the potential to achieve that objective? In my view, the introduction of national strategic planning post 2009 shows that beyond the political miracle, there is an opportunity today in South Africa for us to together to develop a national vision as well as detailed long-term plans about the ideal that we want to achieve, Vision 2025, for instance. And this would require that we identify our objectives, national common objectives, the contribution that each sector can make to the achievement of those objectives, benefits that they can derive from that, trade-offs, sacrifices, and so on. And I think big challenge for the leadership in South Africa amongst all sectors, public, private, civil society, would be whether proactively we take part in this discourse to develop that vision 2025. Also, the other silver lining would be the positives that could be identified or can be identified from the years of high growth, especially between, let's say, 2002 and 2008. High rates of investment by both the public and private sectors, and gross fixed capital formation, I think, had gone up to about 22-23%, approaching the target that we had set ourselves for 25%. In many of the developmental states, it's close to and beyond the 30s. Secondly, during those years of high growth, it became clear that we can indeed reduce unemployment. It was 31% in 2003 and it had come down to 23% in 2008. Some estimates are that we had employment elasticity of GDP growth at about 0.8. And if we had continued along that path, it would have been possible to have unemployment by 2014. Of course, other forces interceded, especially the global economic crisis. Now, the question that we need to pose is if there were to be an integrating storyline to this higher growth trajectory, what elements should it have? There would be many, many elements, but I've identified four strategic ones. Firstly, the infrastructure program. Rolling budgets every 3 years of about 800 billion, which are being invested, which money is being invested in energy, transport, communication, water, housing, and so on. That helps with employment. It also helps with crowding in the private sector. But it's creating a possibility for the emergence of manufacturing capacity for supplier industries to these infrastructure programs. In fact, it is possible to reverse the deindustrialization that has happened in the country, especially in areas such as Ekurhuleni, that is East Rand. And this is already happening. Talking to a friend who has just set up a company to supply brakes, wagon wheels, and other supplies for the big infrastructure, the big program that Transnet has, to the benefit of Transnet, but also to the benefit of the business community. What is critical is that what is happening in South Africa would be like a Sunday school picnic compared to what is going to happen in sub-Saharan Africa in the next 30 years in terms of the massive infrastructure programs that will be undertaken there. So the manufacturing capacity that we develop in South Africa would also have to take into account the demand that will be there in sub-Saharan Africa for the next 30 years and more. It's a major opportunity. Saying this should be part of this integrating storyline at a strategic level about a higher growth trajectory. Second element of that storyline would be the virtuous cycle that naturally emerges as a consequence of growth in South Africa and sub-Saharan Africa, which would then provide profound opportunities for manufacturing. And the things that we have listed here, cell phones, plastic and rubber boots, television monitors, there's a mistake, the kettles, microwave ovens, and so on, toasters. In the research that has been done, these are the major things that we import from China. And the question arises, why don't we develop the manufacturing capacity in South Africa with more people getting employed, the burgeoning of the middle class, with similar things happening in sub-Saharan Africa? Why don't we develop the manufacturing capacity to produce these things? Toasters, why do we have to import them? Suitcases and bags and so on. This would require that we address the constraints to higher rates of growth in various sectors of the economy, including agriculture, agro-processing, and the many sectors that are identified in the Industrial Policy Action Plan of DTI and government. But critically, we also have to ensure that this growth is shared. And this would happen partly through labor absorption, integrating especially micro enterprises into the value chains, unlike other countries. Whilst, say, in Latin America, about 60% of new jobs are created by SMEs. In South Africa, it's about 30 to 40%. And what we discovered is, unlike comparable countries, in South Africa, you have got ubiquity of the big and established companies. If you sought to set up a bakery in a rural area to supply a school for the school feeding scheme, when a procurement has to be done by government, naturally they will find that it is cheaper to buy from the big companies which can provide that bread much cheaper, faster, and with better health considerations. So in building SMEs in South Africa, it's not just creating them to ensure the supply in the various localities where this can happen, but the question is how to integrate them into the existing value chains. Why shouldn't cooperatives of people in rural areas, especially women, produce school uniforms? And why shouldn't they have arrangements with the shops and the companies that supply this? It's that kind of challenge that we need to address. Education and skills and so on are also important to ensure that growth is shared. The third element of this integrating storyline to launch us onto a higher growth trajectory and ensure that we remain there is taking advantage of the endowments that the country has. In my view, mining in South Africa is more than just a sunrise industry in relation to the vagaries of commodity prices. But I think we'll all agree that the super cycle is going to continue for many years to come because of demand from the various growth regions of the world. Secondly, platinum group metals are the epicenter of the search for new energy sources, in particular the hydrogen economy and fuel cell technology. It is estimated that this hydrogen economy might be worth about $400 billion by 2025. Our Minister of Science and Technology says we should have a quarter share of that economy, which, if we were to do a translation of 1 to 10, would mean injecting $1 trillion into the South African economy from one subsector of the mining industry. This is because platinum group metals are the catalysts that are used for translating the hydrogen and water and whatever else into energy. And South Africa has got 80% of the world's reserves of PGMs. So the issue is, how do we take advantage of this endowment? In order to ensure that this happens, we need to develop a proper mining sector strategy and ensure that everything else that we want to do in relation to mining is subsumed to that strategic objective, be it black economic empowerment, be it issues to do with the levels of state involvement and so on. Then the reality is that if indeed we're able to ensure that our mining industry takes advantage of the opportunities that exist, the mining sector could be the launchpad of the economic recovery in the current period. We noticed that even in this period of the commodity super cycle, investment in mining has been going down, or had been going down, in South Africa, whereas in places like Australia and elsewhere, it had been increasing massively. A counterintuitive tendency, and something needs to happen in that regard. And further, talking about mining, we're saying it's more than a sunrise industry, because there is the possibility to have backward and forward linkages that can also help expand our manufacturing capacity and other advantages. And Finland has demonstrated this very clearly, that it is possible to develop a mature industrial sector using resource endowments. They started at the level of mere extraction with little processing, some level of processing and local engineering, locally based engineering services with some value-added products. And we know now this is with regard to their wood industry, that they are at the level of incorporating exports of technology and machinery, sophisticated resource-based products, engineering services, and so on. And there is no reason why South Africa should not do the same in relation to these resource endowments that we have. And the last element of the integrating storyline for our growth trajectory should be opportunities in the green economy. Yes, they do present, the green economy does present many challenges, but there are also many, many opportunities that can be exploited in biofuel, solar wind, fuel cell technology, biomass, and so on, with their own forward and backward linkages and job opportunities that can be created from that. And this would require better allocation to research and development, better regulation, procurement systems in government and elsewhere, and even in the private sector, should take this issue into account. Tariffs on feeds and so on. Now, it would be well and good to talk about the opportunities, the potential that we have. But the reality is that resources are limited, whilst the needs and wants of society are limitless. And therefore, in planning, you have to make choices. And this is one critical attribute of leadership in developmental states. And if we were to look at South Africa, what kinds of choices would we have to make in order to ensure that we launch ourselves on that growth path? Just to give some examples, issues of price and access. Suppose we are all aware of the debate that took place in the past 2 years about electricity tariffs. If you have to provide electricity, you can't continually charge at prices that are below cost, because that would be unsustainable. But because it's a social service, you have to ensure that you balance between price and access. Even as an economic service, if we do it, increase prices in an irresponsible manner, it would negatively impact on business competitiveness. So faced with those choices, how do you address this matter? That is where the issue of strategic leadership arises. Can talk about savings and consumption. We know even when during that period of high growth, when gross fixed capital formation was increasing at a high rate, many of the resources for the investment came from outside the country, because South Africa has a low savings rate. Whilst in places like China, it might be at the level of 30%, I think 35% and more. In South Africa, we're at 15% of GDP. In part, it might be a reflection of poverty, but in part, it's also the culture of consumption. But we all know to accumulate capital for investment purposes might require that you limit short-term consumption beyond basic needs, especially with regard to luxury goods that are import sensitive. There is that challenge. Do we then say to Professor Ewin, he should not buy the Ferrari that he is intending to, but rather invest his money. And how will he respond to that? Trade-off and choice that the leadership of South Africa, I'm saying in civil society, in the private sector, in government, need to discuss. There's the issue of contribution and reward in income distribution. As we know, executive packages can be quite excessive and worsen inequality, whilst on the other hand, high wage increases without productivity improvements can be unsustainable. How do you strike a balance? Contribution to the production and services processes and reward in income distribution. How do we ensure higher levels of equality? Japan historically managed to do this pre-tax in terms of actual income as skills of the workers improved. In Sweden, whilst there is an element of that, it's post-tax with the state as the instrument of redistribution. How do we deal with these challenges? You know, if you were to talk about higher taxes in South Africa, issues about the capacity of the state and its performance in delivery will arise, so you require legitimacy. Other trade-offs, insiders and outsiders, it happens in the private sector where sometimes big companies that dominate particular sectors use all kinds of machinations to block new entrants. So you have insiders and outsiders. But it also happens in relation to the union movement and workers. In pursuit of decent work, the union sometimes negotiate packages that push small companies out of the market. I suppose we might be aware of what happened recently in Newcastle. Central Bargaining Council demands a particular or sets a particular minimum wage, and many of the companies in Newcastle were going to close, and its workers there, in defiance of SAG to their union, who said we are prepared to accept these wages so that we should have jobs. So how do you deal with the challenge where even unions can be, employed workers can be insiders who block those who are unemployed because of the structure of the reward system? There's also the issue of long-term rewards and instant gratification, in the sense that in government sometimes there's a temptation to use high tax yields during boom years instead of adopting a counter-cyclical fiscal policy. In the private sector, we know short-termism has become the stock in trade, where managers are required to provide positive returns on a quarterly basis ad infinitum, which returns, or a large part of which returns, are then distributed as dividends. In part, this is responsible for the global economic crash that we had, Enron and the banks later. Now, it is possible to find a compromise in looking at these trade-offs and pursue seemingly contradictory objectives, but often it is unlikely. What is important, though, is that in giving leadership on these issues, it is critical to attach a temporal dimension to it, to say if a choice had to be made, it would apply for a certain period when objectives for that choice have been achieved, you then move to a different approach. And I think this might be one of the weaknesses of the new growth path as currently crafted. Because with regard to the issue of packages and so on, it talks about this happening over a period of 10 years and more. Whereas you can say for a particular period you might need this, but this would then change later. And to be able to do all this requires leadership. The last category of issues that I'll deal with is about state capacity. Developmental states play a critical role in leading economic development, in policy making, regulation, R&D, procurement, and so on. And currently, I would say there are some elements or some areas in which we are ramping up state capacity, strategic planning, monitoring, and evaluation. There are many difficulties and challenges at local government level that need to be dealt with. But we also need to ensure that legitimacy of the state is underpinned by the kind of conduct on the part of the leadership that encourages that. But one of the major weaknesses that we have is about professionalism and stability in the public service. Linda Ways, that I referred to earlier, argues that in developmental states, you need to insulate the management or the public servants against corruption, political favors, special interests, amongst others, through appropriate modes of recruitment and promotion. It's one challenge that we need to address. And one of the lessons that we are learning from the transitions that have taken place since 1994 during elections or after elections is that sometimes you find wholesale changes in management as new political principles come in, and that instability in the public service does not assist in building a developmental state. Developmental states have stable professional civil services that are able to sustain particular approaches over many years, even if political principles may change. And there's also the challenge after elections, even if it's one party, even if it's the ANC, for the new brooms to create an impression that they can sweep aside many of the things that happened before as they create an impression of introducing new things. Sometimes changes are required, but this should not be done in a way that undermines the basic structure and functionality of the state. In giving leadership, it is also critical to master the science and art of statecraft and manage what I would call the politics of distraction. One, we have got an anomaly in South Africa where the majority of the political and state leadership and that of the business leadership have different backgrounds, culture, networks, outlooks, and so on. In developmental states that have succeeded, Malaysia, Japan, and so on, the leadership in politics, in management of the state, would have gone to the same schools, have the same background, enjoy the same sport as the leadership of the business sector. How do we bridge that gap? That's one challenge that we need to address. Further, also to appreciate that beyond the formality of elections, state legitimacy critically depends on all sectors being given a voice. It's one interesting issue that we are still looking at the Mapungubwe Institute, in addition to issues about PGM and so on, platinum group metals, with SAWID and IDT. Alec will remember that there was a presentation after they had done an international tour that amongst the lessons that we need to study and implement in terms of poverty reduction programs would be the successful programs in, surprise, surprise, Tunisia. We know what is happening in Tunisia now. In part, it would be as a consequence of lack of democracy, unlike in our own country. But in part, as I'm saying, this needs to be studied further, might be a reflection of an experience that even Zimbabwe had. Good education systems, many graduates, but you are unable to provide them with employment. You'll remember that the trigger to the popular revolt in Tunisia was a graduate, I think, in computer sciences who couldn't get a job, was selling wares in the street. The police decided to confiscate his wares and he burnt himself. Self-immolation. But the point that we're making is voice, ensuring that interventions to deal with income poverty are more than just about social programs, but also employment. But whilst we have talked about the social compact, it is not easy to accomplish it. In a society such as ours, with the historical fault lines, contradictory interests and so on, the differences that exist amongst the various social partners, like between workers and employers, can lead to paralysis. And therefore, the leadership of the state becomes critical in making tough choices when and where the sectoral leadership is unable to do so. Some have jocularly said that in addition to democracy and those various capacities and attributes of a developmental state that we referred to, perhaps there is also an attribute that it should have an element of Bonapartism. But more positively, it should be what Peter Evans refers to as embedded autonomy. It should be networked amongst all the social actors, but at the same time be independent of them. There shouldn't be institutional capture by one social sector. It should be able to give leadership. If there is a problem such as in Newcastle, where the trade union movement behaves as a, to paraphrase Dante, when the people say death to our lives and lives to our death, you need leadership. The state should be able to intervene and say what is in the national interest is the following. There's also, of course, the challenge in a democracy that articulation of political views does sometimes lend itself to hyperbole, especially during election campaigns or intra-party leadership contests. And it is important that society is able to discount that, to manage that, and to discount what one would call the discourse outliers. Because there is a danger that paralysis can set in because some young person in the ANC has made a particular statement. The local government elections are coming, and people will be swearing at one another. And sometimes the tendency in our country, amongst the leadership in the private sector and elsewhere, it's to then believe that Armageddon is about to happen. In mature democracies, you discount those things. All kinds of battles happen amongst and within political parties, Labour Party, Conservative Party in the UK, and so on. We need to have a level of maturity that we discount those kinds of issues. What I would call white noise. Statistically. So in conclusion, in response to the question, are we a developmental state? The answer is no, not yet. We do have the potential to become one, but introduction of national strategic planning is critical, but also secondly, to make progress will depend not only on the state, but also societal leaders. Whether we have the acumen to identify and contribute to a national vision, ensure its implementation, and where necessary, be prepared to sacrifice for its realization. The National Planning Commission, to which I belong, working with, of course, the Department of Economic Development, Economic Development Department. I'm saying this because when I was still in government and we're doing acronyms as the new departments were being formed, realized Department of Economic Development would be dead. So they call themselves EDD. Working with them, we'll be developing during the course of this year that national strategic vision, trying to describe the growth trajectory, contribution that various sectors can make. And in that sense, or rather, the National Planning Commission intends to complete this work towards the end of the year. So in that sense, incidentally, as we turn 17, this is our test year, our metric. How we manage that debate on the growth path and national strategic planning will determine whether we break out along the new path. Thank you.